So it's a great time to do this. And recently, Fed presidents have walked back 3 rate cuts for 2024 in the last couple of weeks. You know, we had like one Fed president after another, you know, saying it's going to be 2, it might be 1. You got Neel Kashkari comes out and says it might be 0. Now there's even a possibility that there might be one more rate hike in the works as well. And the bond market obviously has already walked back 6 plus rate cuts that it priced in December, with longer term yields rising back up to 4.6, 4.7 in the 10s and 30s. That's in the US, obviously. And then even more recently, like as far as this being a turning point, you know, even Magnificent Stocks, or some of the Magnificent Seven stocks, have been under a lot of pressure from the last quarter's highs. Tesla being one of the big notable ones, Apple too. Even Nvidia has had some retracement here and there and pressure. But on the other hand, energy, commodities, and gold have been strong. Crypto has been maintaining itself in the 60,000 range. So we're at a crossroads here, right? I mean, like, what do you think? Like, what do you both think comes next?
Yeah, do we buy the dip or sell the rip? I'm with you. That's why I want to talk to Paul. Yeah. Paul, how are you guys looking at it through SAI charts lenses here? What are you seeing in the breadth? You know, you've kind of got stocks, bonds, commodities, currencies, maybe gold is a little bit of a unique commodity as well. You've got the crypto sector, and then you got the sectors underneath, which I think there is a bit of evidence of rotation going on. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you're seeing on the side of breadth, because sometimes those can be a bit of an early warning, whether it's the bullish percents or the stocks above 50 days, those types of things. And then, you know, digging down into the sector side, what's holding up better, what's not? I think there's a great discussion in the energy and materials sector. I think there's a great discussion in the gold sector. And a lot of these trades are under-owned, it seems to me. So, and then we can get into, you know, what you're seeing across the country spectrum, you know, countries and currencies, because underlying those different economies are often different sort of regime structures, more commodity-based countries and less and more commodity-using-based countries. And then I think, you know, something else is the sort of the yen and what it is signifying, you know. Nikkei has finally come back and reached the highs of 40 yeah. years ago. And what is the weakness in the yen maybe signifying? So why don't you start where you would start from a top-down framework and then, you know, point out some of this stuff that's going on sure. for us.
Yeah. So I wanted to also, before we get started on that, I wanted to also bring up, there's a couple things that happened this week or that have come up this week. Round the clock, 24/7 equity markets trading. You know, that's going to change things, obviously. You know, from you know, a lot of institutional trading taking place that market opens and closes. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to probably see a lot of market participants trying to take advantage of, you know, the wee hours, right? And lower volumes. And also, I think just to sort of dovetail into our discussion around perhaps interest rates and fixed income when we get to it, is today's this week's early news about Bank of America and its interest rate risk coming sort of into the sunlight, that they've got market book value that looks closer to $100 billion rather than $265 billion, and that's obviously owing to rising interest rates, and also. Earning 3% on its assets when funding costs are 6%, right? I mean, is that a canary in a coal mine? I mean, it's not that, you know, Bank of America is the only bank that's having issues stemming from last year's, from what started last year and benefiting from the BTFD. And, what do you see happening also in financials, since that's a very important holding in a lot of people's portfolios? Because I know they're not related specifically to SIA, but I'm just, you know, both of you, Mike, Paul?
Well, I mean, on 24/7 trading, from my perspective, is, I mean, I think you're, the pressure from the crypto markets is leaking into the other markets. You're going to have that variance in volume. You're going to have your peak trading times based on, you know, the circadian rhythm of the various markets across the world. We trade futures markets, and so we are used to kind of 23-hour trading. So, you know, basically markets start opening in Australia for us, and then they cross the world. And then there's about an hour when the sun crosses over the Pacific Ocean, and there really isn't a lot of land masses with humans on it. And so traditionally that's been a time frame when, you know, all the markets around the world are closed for that hour. And, you know, that's when we process signals and do all of our calculations and then send out orders through the various markets across the world over that time frame. And you're always faced with this, though. So it's not a new challenge. For example, you know, if you're trading the Japanese ETF, and you're trading it at, you know, 12 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you're trading a European ETF. Those markets are largely closed, but you are trading them. So ETFs and futures markets have largely been engaged in this kind of practice. Broadening it out makes some sense, obviously. And, you know, the things that come along with that, though, are the types of things that you have seen in crypto markets, where you get runs and leveraged participants can be taken out of the market while they're sleeping or while they're underlevered in moments of crisis. So, you know, it's an interesting thing. It's something that we're in tune with already from the way, you know, we've operated. But, you know, I think to a great degree, it's already happening. But, you know, that would be my thoughts on it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you're already seeing, okay, a big company like NVIDIA or somebody releases earnings after hours. They're already moving the market and the after trade market. It's kind of already acting like a 24/7 trading market a lot of the time, with the way that you can do futures and things like that around different equities. So you're right. I mean, we're a more global, connected world than ever before. There's markets all over the world that are open basically at all times, like you said, 23 hours a day. I think there is some challenges, though, right? There's going to be the challenges from the data standpoint. The risk standpoint, I think, goes up for anything that can be traded 24/7, because like you said, it's going to become more algorithm-based. It's going to become more stop losses, right, like that, just to control your overall risk, because you can't monitor something physically 24/7. You have to write programs, AI, algorithms. So I think that's going to actually affect the markets more as we go. And we might actually see kind of an all-in 24/7 trading and then a pullback and say, okay, well, maybe there's something in between here where we can still have some liquidity after hours, but still more control. So I think it's actually going to hurt potentially retail, other people that don't have those resources to kind of protect yourself after hours. And you, like you said, Mike, you see it in the crypto market already, where, yeah, you know, people get in on the hype. That's going to happen more and more through Reddit, through these different meme stocks or whatever you want to call them.
Robin,
that's only going to get worse. And I think the person that's going to be hurt in the end is the people without the resources to protect themselves from those bigger runs that could happen. So it increases the risk in my viewpoint, but it increases the liquidity. And there is some positives too from this, especially with the larger global trade. But I don't think we can have one without the other. And the risk is to a bigger viewpoint of ours for the retail public, I would say.
Yeah.
And then for things like, you know, Bank of America, the market often knows a lot of this news ahead of time. And I mean, I'm just looking at, you know, the chart of Bank of America, you know, 12-month high, you know, and, you know, clawing its way back to the, you know, the highs of 2021 potentially. But it doesn't look like the market's particularly concerned. And I think that's, you know, it's expectations versus what is actually reported. And you saw that in Tesla stock last night, where, I mean, they reported fairly poor numbers historically speaking, and then the stock's up, you know, 10% in the aftermarket. So, and then, you know, I guess, you know, so it is a function always of what's the expected outcome and what's been priced in. And it's always what occurs vis-a-vis expectations, not what occurs. So it feels like, you know, the report, and I'm not an expert on Bank of America by any stretch, but, you know, we're talking about a news item that has been reported and it's fully baked into the price, and the price is not really moving in any significant way. And it's maintaining this 52 week push into new highs. Now, it's not, you know, a 10-year new high, which is a totally different scenario. And we can go through, I think we'll get through some of the mindset there in gold. But it's a, you know, it's a 52 week area of highs, and the news is there. So it feels like probably the markets were pretty aware of that. And, you know, the price mechanisms already reflected that news.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas, you know, Tesla comes in and, you know, throws up everywhere and the stock's up, it's up 10%. Yeah. And obviously people had thought it would be worse.
So, I mean, is that short covering? You know, is there short covering there obviously happening, like people, you know, buying back their shares off the bottom? Yeah.
Yeah. And again, I think it's the expectations, right? So the expectations fell in a place where the broad expectations expressed in the market were that it should have been worse. And so, you know, you see this price for the Dow. Will that continue? Will we see the strength dissipate and a continuation of the downtrend? You know, that stock is on I-90 South at the moment, right? So the trend is not your friend right now. You ain't on I-90 North. So, you know, these are just things. If, you know, if I were looking at a stock, I like to have the trend as my friend. And right now the trend is down. Now, is this the beginning of a turn and the start of a new, trend for Tesla? I have no idea. I will say that my impression is from, you know, just the bits of media that I get, and this is just my humble opinion, is that there's a lot of people saying, is it time to buy Tesla yet? Right? And it's time to buy Tesla and it's down 40%. Where people aren't saying, is it time to buy gold yet? And gold's at like all-time highs and has broken out of a pattern that's like 15 years old. Those two setups, you know, mentally are different for me. And I, you know, I prefer the second to the first. In my career started in the 90s, and I remember people asking me, NASDAQ 4,000, when do we buy it again? NASDAQ 3,000, when do we buy it again? NASDAQ 2,000, do we buy it yet?
Well, so, yeah, and, I mean, you know, this is where SIA charts can really be handy, right? I mean, I think, you know, when you're faced with these decisions, potentially, you know, facing biases and facing even, you know, the recency bias, at least FOMO and FOMO, you know, buy the dip versus, you know, looking at the longer term trends and buying a 15 year pattern that has broken. You know, those are the kinds of things that you can unearth, right?
Right. And where's everybody's mental capital? Where's their story too sticky? Like, maybe the story in Tesla at the moment's a little too sticky, and, you know, the gold story is not sticky enough. Yeah. But this is where, again, a rules-based systematic way to bring some rigor to your investment decision-making, whether you're an allocator, a registered investment advisor, an individual investor, you've got to have a game plan. And the thing about, you know, the beautiful simplicity of a point and figure chart is you can define your risk very well. You can think through the risk that you want to put in your portfolio. Let's say you have a stock you want to buy and stock X is $100, and you can see a clear point at $90 where you should, you know, I was wrong. You can put that in your risk calculation and say, well, okay, I could take a 10% loss on this, and maybe the stock goes up 20%. So I've got a 2-to-1 risk reward ratio. I put my stop loss in, and, you know, I don't know the future. And so thinking through these types of risk managed positions is in recognition that you don't know the future and you don't know how high the stock could go either. And so, you know, one of the most successful, I think, you know, elements of investing is to keep those winners, beat them to death, and be ridiculously disciplined about those things that are showing you losses in your portfolio and just continuing to prune those.
Well, as an advisor, you don't want to be making arbitrary, emotionally biased calls on your clients' portfolios, let alone your own, but specifically your clients' portfolios. And you're not, and as an advisor, yes, you have access to big institutional traders through their, through their solutions or products, but you're not an institutional trader. You don't have the algorithms at your disposal. You're not using that kind of technology in your day-to-day practice. So how can you, how can you come as close to, that without having to be that math genius that writes his own code or her own code and breaks the market, in her office, right? So let me.
Well, I think I'll let yeah, Paul handle that one for out of the gate. I have some thoughts on that, but I think Paul's got some.
So let me kick it off. Well, welcome and thank you so much for listening. I'm Pierre Daly, managing editor at advisoranalyst.com, and this is Raise Your Average. Co-hosting with me is Mike Philbrick, CEO at Resolve Asset Management Global. Our very special guest is an extraordinary figure in financial markets, known widely for his ability to interpret the complexities of markets from his post, where he gets to see the end results of an enormous amount of market data being distilled into unique, systematized insights and investment calls for everything that is being traded. Paul Kornfeld, president of SIA Charts, is here.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Paul, welcome, and I know we've already been chatting, but it's great to have you back, and it's great to do this quarterly with you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me again. Wanted to jump off the Tesla conversation if you want. I actually prepared something on that stock, so thanks for the setup.
Do it.
So one of the things you guys were talking about was having a systematic way to help identify when those trends are, like you said, short selling, covering, or if this is something different, right? So this is just the last 4 years of Tesla. This chart kind of highlights where this stock ranks relative to other opportunities you can buy within the NASDAQ 100. So obviously there's other strong names within that report. Just because it has a yellow or red call here doesn't necessarily mean you're losing money on that stock. But as you can see in this chart, every X in here represents positive movement for Tesla. I think I have it at a 4% scale. So it's quite a large move that we're looking at. And you can see that upside was captured mostly in this kind of green zone of that report, what we call the favorite zone, where it's in the top 25% of opportunities comparatively to other things. So in 2020, 2021, a majority of the time it was in that favorite zone, where it moved from about $18 to over $400. Since then, 2022 was a significant downturn for most tech stocks. And Tesla was actually didn't have the worst drawdown out of all of them compared to the next slide we might look at, but it was still pretty significant and had an even larger one in 2023. Since then, it's tried to rally back as part of the Magnificent Seven in the beginning of 2023. We didn't catch it at the very bottom. Really, it only entered kind of that favorite zone in the middle of the year. And again, there was better opportunities out there. NVIDIA was up over, 200% or something last year. Don't quote me on that. But it was, again, what it's trying to say is there's actually better opportunities out there. It wasn't the best performing name in the Magnificent Seven last year. And since then, again, here's the kind of recent sell signal around $220. And now it was trading, as of this morning, $145. Obviously, we did see that jump after the earnings call. But a lot of that information was actually mostly negative, like you pointed out, Mike. Is this going to keep going? Yeah, they reduced their prices. They're laying off, 10% of their workforce. Like, there's some major things that can turn the stock around for sure, but still not as rosy of an outlook as we would like to see. We'd like to see it hitting new revenue highs, new sales targets, expanding on that like we see in NVIDIA and other companies, other tech companies that are really embracing AI. And again, Tesla's an amazing company, love it, have friends that work there, love their innovation strategy. But all we're trying to do is say, hey, right now, it's just a higher risk for us, even with the recent earnings release. So I think this kind of puts it in perspective of how those signals can change quickly, especially in kind of tech stocks like Tesla, and kind of paints a picture of some of the downside savings of just having a tool, a signal, just to help understand when those things do change. So.
And I think, you know, Pierre, to your point earlier, how does someone try and navigate all of this when they're competing in such a competitive landscape, and what tools can they use, right? So smaller investors and smaller allocators have the opportunity to embrace both mandate flexibility and portfolio agility. So one is their mandate flexible enough? You know, in a strategic asset allocation in large institutions, there's a very, very small amount of wiggle room in thinking through how much the mandate can change. The other problem is that with very large pools of assets, your portfolio agility is low because you have to move a ton of assets to make allocation changes. Smaller investors, if they can embrace for a portion of their portfolio, some portfolio agility and build in some mandate flexibility, what they can do is use the well-trodden factors, in this case, like momentum. What Paul was pointing out was a comparative relative strength situation between Tesla and the other stocks, either in the index or in its subgroup, and saying it's actually performing better than its cohorts. And that factor in the investment research, that sort of trend / relative strength factor, is a factor that's pretty heaped in kind of scientific rigor where, yeah, if something's done well, it kind of generally continues to do well. And if something's done poorly, it kind of generally continues to do poorly. Now, there are turns within that, and it works over time, not all of the time. But those are the types of factors that an individual investor can embrace. And with tools like SAI charts, there are other providers out there, but Paul's our guy today and he's giving his time today. So right now it's SAI charts bust, but there's a lot of work that goes into that system, which allows you to pull that information out. So an individual stock versus its index peers, a sector, a country, an area. You know, we talked a little bit about, you know, commodities, commodity producing countries, currencies, bonds versus stocks, US stocks versus Canadian stocks versus international stocks. All of these relative pairs can, you know, sort of, you can put them through an NBA basketball Final Four, come out with who's the strongest. And then there's a layer of risk management on top of that. But this is a framework where smaller investors who have that portfolio agility and mandate flexibility can take advantage of that through the lens of relative strength and risk management versus, you know, just fundamentals. So the other side of things is I think this is a complement to what's going on in fundamentals, which, you know, Paul and you both highlighted.
I like that sell signal at 220. That's
it never feels good though. It never feels good.
In hindsight,
never feels good to have it at 400 and then say getting out of 220 and I did good.
Go back to the Tesla slide for one second. How do you differentiate? What was, like, if you looked just at the previous period in your red, yellow, green chart? What's the differentiation between the sell signal at that point, at the point where at the red circle, versus the previous downstretch where it dipped into the red and then right back up and then shortly thereafter back up into the yellow and green? How do your systems differentiate between those two calls, those two activities in the market?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I'm obviously highlighting the bigger moves, but you can see even within this bigger move in 2020, it hit a red zone for whatever reason on a pullback and then jumped back in, actually at a lower time period. And then the most recent one that you're referencing, this one, again, you kind of see it on the chart here very briefly. For whatever reason, it fell off. Again, could have missed earnings, could, you know, something, moment, momentum based, you know, had that. It's a very high traded stock. There's a lot of things at play. And then it actually got back in for a brief period and then out again.
And what was the corresponding price at the August September call, at the August September indicator?
Sure, I'll just pull it up on my screen here.
Just for the sake of discussion, I'm just curious to see, like, you know, was it it was a higher price, I take it, given what the point and figure chart shows.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll pull that up here in a sec. Yeah, but what's going on is obviously throughout the history, this is a volatile stock. There is going to be time periods where, you know, there's those signals. What we try to do is just follow it. Usually on average, it's staying up in this green zone for a 6 to 18 month period. You can obviously see by not staying up here that long, it's kind of showing a little bit of weakness as well, that the signal isn't that strong. So that's also something to keep in mind. Right now, Tesla's ranked basically at the bottom of this report. Pulling up the interactive chart here. Can you guys see this? Perfect.
Yeah.
So yeah, we can go back in and see kind of, okay, it entered here at 224 and left at basically 220.
Same price.
So really not, about the same price kind of when it entered that zone. We do have kind of a faster sell signal that sometimes initiates in this yellow zone to get out a little bit faster as well. Then it entered in around 273 and then exited again. You can see even one day difference from 242 to 220. So that recent kind of move up wasn't profitable, but again, then it's down another 40% after that. Right. So that's the risk management part of it. We don't know if this is going to be another bull run. Like if you go back further to a 5-year period, okay, this is for the majority of the time going from again, $300 to 660 or 680, right? So again, this is a very volatile stock. So you see kind of smaller time periods where it's in, but sometimes those are pretty major moves. Like in 2020, you can kind of go back and see that. So yeah, it is interactive where you can kind of see that time period throughout the history of that we have within that.
And it's relative to the NASDAQ 100, this call. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Relative to other names. So that was going to be kind of my next point is, okay, at the same point you're potentially getting out of Tesla, you can also find new names up here at the top, like a Netflix, Nvidia, Meta, Constellation Energy, right? That's where that opportunity cost of saying something or getting out of a Tesla and moving that money back in is potentially even more profitable, right? So if we do look at, again, another trade you could have made over that same time period, if you're out of Tesla in whenever it was that, you know, the fall of last year, you know, I think it was in around September. Okay, well, you could have been in Meta, that's up, you know, 147% over that same time frame. I guess that's going back to March, where again, capturing a majority of the moves and hopefully avoiding the larger moves. So this was one of its larger drawdowns I think it's ever had in its short history as a company, down 76% in 2022 into 2023. And then did we catch the bottom? No, that's never going to be the goal. But getting a majority of that, so it entered the favorite zone. I'm not sure why it's not showing up correctly on this chart, but this checking this, it was around $200 that it kind of signaled and up, which is almost close to $500 over that time period now. So those are the kind of pairs trade, if you kind of think about it, if you want to go into that area. It's just trying to find the opportunity cost. Obviously, I handpicked examples out of the Magnificent Seven where a lot of that performance is coming from in the major indices. So if you're tracking the S&P 500, things like that, a lot of these tech companies have grown in value and really are moving that index more than ever before. So obviously, you know, if you can kind of track these names, you get a larger insight into kind of what's happening. And that's part of the reason, I think, kind of going back to some earlier questions, is why are some of these companies or sectors still kind of hanging on when there's a lot of other kind of top-down information that maybe isn't pushing the markets forward? But it's because, you know, Meta came out with an amazing, I think it was just last week, new AI, Llama 3, language learning, processing, like NLP, and just amazing software that is getting really rave reviews of you know, being able to go head to head with OpenAI and ChatGPT-4 and some of these. It's, you know, they're on the cusp of this, they're moving forward, and that's what the market's kind of pricing in, and it keeps pushing them upwards. So there's some of the more fundamental reasons or quantitative reasons of why that's happening. And all we're trying to say is, hey, that is contributing to more demand for the stock.
Yeah.
And relative to other places you could put your money, that's kind of what, you know, this report summarizes is here's the current look of all those kind of tech names in the NASDAQ 100 where, yeah, here's maybe a group that I'm tracking or movement up. And yeah, it's not moving up, but it's still hopefully gaining that value and helps you diversify as well. Here's DoorDash and energy and then Constellation Energy Company and different material companies, leisure companies, right? It can really help diversify your portfolio away from maybe some of the bigger risk stocks over that same time period.
The other thing, if you just go back to the chart as well, none of this is easy. The stock Meta bounced off a low, you know, $90 and then went to 200 and then was a buy. Right. So the other thing is great stocks like Meta are like these tech stocks are almost never going to trade at multiples that seem reasonable. Right. Yep. That's the one thing. So, you know, forward P multiples are not really indicative of any kind of price change. So the fundamental analysis of it is kind of flawed too. So people looking for certain stocks to, you know, tech stocks to fall into value criteria, they're just never going to own them. And when they own them, they're not going to want to own them. So here you've got a situation where stock bottomed at 80 and was a buy at 225, breaking out of the pattern above, right? But at that point, you can see that you had places where you might manage your risk, right? So you can see sort of a $200 line in the sand, you're breaking out at 225, you got kind of a 10% stop loss. You do have to consider the volatility of the stock itself as well, because volatility is a random function. And you don't want to get sort of kicked out of your stock as a function of the random price action that might be going on in the market. So again, if your stop has to be much further away, and that stop can be in the market or it can be a mental stop, but wherever you're going to delineate the risk that you have, if it's a really large area, then that's a lot of risk. So you would reduce your position size, right? So instead of having $100,000 on in the stock, you might only have $50,000. Because the distance to the place where you'd say, ooh, I'm wrong, it's not Meta, it's Tesla. And we don't know going forward, right? We only see the setup. And so we see the setup and we execute. And if we would have seen the setup both in Tesla and in Meta in that time in the bottoming of the market in late 2023, you'd put both trades on, you'd have been stopped out of your Tesla with a 10% loss, and you would have kept your Meta for 150% gain. That's what we mean about beating these winners to death. Make sure those winners stay and the losers go, because they are going to look kind of the same. You know, at the initial setup, they're going to kind of look the same. And then you can think about, you know, rather than waiting for the thing to turn into the yellow zone, investors could say, well, there's an area of congestion at the all-time high breakout. There's an area of congestion just below that in the 350 range, where one could then set another area of a limiting risk factor, where I would sell some at that point. If it drew back to that point, I would sell a little bit, right? And I would say, well, that's an area of support. And then it's a function of, you know, you as an investor, it's a very personal thing. How loose are you going to keep your pants is a Jerry Parker, a Jerry Parkerism, how loose are you going to keep your stops? Because a lot of these stocks that are mega winners, Amazon is a great example, had two or three 90% drawdowns on the way to its massive success, right? So can you tolerate that kind of drawdown to get the success? Is that the company that makes it through the drawdown and doesn't go bankrupt? It's not, you know, pets.com. If you will. So anyway, there's a lot to think through, but again, having this framework and just looking at this little chart here, you can see the areas of X's and O's, which are those congestion areas. You can see that rip off the bottom, and you're not taking a guess at 88. It's the bottom I want to buy. You're waiting till 200, which is going to be uncomfortable. But again, I just want to stress that, you know, systems are hard, and that's why they're not often followed, but I think they're well worth it in investors and thinking through the framework to say, what should I be looking at? You know, the list that Paul showed is here are the top names, and note that there's a number of names that are not just tech names.
That's an example that would make you want to revisit you know, revisit the idea if you haven't already. It's hard. I mean, look, if you just as you know, as you said, Mike, I mean, I think, you know, at 80 or 90, nobody wanted it except, you know, short sellers covering, right?
Historically, and
it's one of those examples, like, you know, Mike, we've talked about, you know, where, you know, there were times where, you know, Google, Alphabet were, you know, Google was down 90%. And who wanted it then? And, you know, like anybody looking back at that historical moment in the price of the stock would say, you know, God, if only I could go back. And if only you could go back, you would probably do exactly the same thing you did in the first place.
Yeah. It looks so easy. Yeah. It looks so easy. We're faced in the current market construct. We're faced with a bit of that, right? We do have a correction that's going on. And I jokingly quipped, are we buying the dip or are we selling the rip? Because we don't know. My kind of gut feeling, very personal gut feeling, and I don't, you know, take any of my gut feelings. They don't make it into our portfolios because we're very systematic in our approach there. My gut feeling is we probably have more to run, and that's a function of liquidity and the election cycle. You know, this correction may go a little bit more, but, you know, it's probably, you know, persist. But I do see that there are some risks on the horizon. You know, you have an inverted yield curve that's been around for a long time, and the length of a yield curve inversion is often, well, is correlated. It's a very small number of circumstances, but is correlated to the depth of the recession. And the only inversion that is longer than the one we're in right now is 1928. So again, I think that just underscores that the risk management people should be conducting in the portfolios, whether that's allocators, whether that's investment advisors. Again, if you have the portfolio agility and mandate flexibility, you should be thinking about how you're going to employ that. If you can incorporate alternative investments and processes like trend following that tend to have these non-correlated moments when, you know, indices have troubles, these are things that I think are going to be increasingly important to incorporate into portfolio systems, like, you know, having some risk management in with your SAI process. They're going to become increasingly important as we go into the next couple of years. And maybe they won't be. Maybe it keeps going up, up and away, but we just don't know.
I think personally, I agree with you a lot, right? There's a lot of risks on the table. It's the overextended rally, yet you can't fight the market, right? You can't at the same point. You know, we are following those money flows, those trends, and the money flow difference recently has been into commodities, right? We've seen that move up. That's not a secret. Energy, gold at all-time highs, silver up 25% or something. Like, year to date, there's a lot of strength there. But, you know, where we're at is we're still in the favorite zone of our risk management tool, but it comes with caution, right? It's like you talk about. And, you know, Canadian equity moving up, commodities moving up, really, that's just the strength of the commodities. When we kind of look at the equity markets over the last year, it's mostly been favorable, but there hasn't been a clear winner. That U.S. Equity area where we've been in over the last year, kind of, you know, that can make a big difference in the portfolio. So obviously, if you look at commodities or something on top of this, it's going to add even more value. But overall, throughout this time period where we thought there was going to be, what, 6 or 8 cuts, depending on who you talk to at the end of December, that's changed a lot since then, yet the market's still crept up, had a good start to the year. A lot of that's come through different sector rotation. So we'll kind of maybe look at that here next, but I think that's going to be the more important part going forward, right? There is still going to be pockets of opportunities, but overall the S&P 500 might not have the great rest of the year that maybe it started with, right? There might be more opportunities to diversify, maybe away from some of the interest sensitive areas into, again, commodities or communications or something like that, wherever that those money flows are going. Maybe that is financials and banking.
Across the cap weighted too, right? The other thing is the cap weighting, you know, it's been a large mega cap market. So what about mid caps? What about small caps? Those can be areas of, and then you've got international versus domestic as well. But yeah, keep rolling.
So yeah, this is kind of where we see over the last year, and that trend has continued. The green kind of is, again, that favorable kind of risk management. Yellow is a little bit more caution that we saw last fall, and really it moved out of that pretty quickly. And then, you know, from a world market standpoint, where we're seeing that is it's still it's quite, you know, balanced in a way, right? We're seeing a little bit more weakness in really the Asia area, Asia Pacific area. China has been a laggard, but some of that growth is starting to accelerate, starting to come back. That's helped copper. That's helped some of the commodities. That's really what was dragging down a lot of that growth there too. And this, you know, we talked about different currencies coming into effect. We're definitely seeing that in Turkey. We're definitely seeing that in Argentina. We're definitely seeing a lot of this is actually more of a currency play than, you know, actual performance of outperformance from Turkey. But when you're looking at international opportunities, it is important to diversify, see what's out there. You know, Canada, where we're located, is not necessarily the best place to put that money if you can look for developed Europe or even Japan, things like that. Again, Japan's not ranked as high on our system. This number here, people on the podcast maybe can't hear this, but we are ranking this against all the different countries in the world against each other. The higher number that you see is the higher ranked it is against all other countries. And then this is just kind of ranking it by recent performance year to date to give you some idea of where those money flows have been going internationally. So overall, again, international is still an opportunity, but there's so many geopolitical events going on that are going to affect this going forward that this will change quickly. There will be opportunities, again, outside of North America that we want to keep an eye on. And some of that, like you said, is currency related. Others is going to be opportunity related that, you know, okay, maybe Mexico turns around, maybe Brazil turns around, you know, different countries are going to be affected by the Israeli-Iran conflict, right? Like there will be these kind of changes very quickly, but, you know, we still want to help people understand where those money flows are going. And it's still the trend has been developed over emerging for a while, and that really hasn't changed in our system. But there is certain emerging pockets that are going to pop up over time.
Yeah, the interesting thing in Japan too, and some of these major markets will have currency hedged versions of their exposures. So Japan with a currency hedge, so long stock, short yen, has been a magnificent performer, and those are available fairly widely in the ETF suite. That's something I've been pointing out in some of the discussions I've had on Bloomberg and whatnot. But so you have not only the countries that are here just on a, you know, sort of a currency neutral basis, but you can overlay some currency plays on them via different exchange traded products that can provide a nice bump to performance for whatever your thesis might be.
And then we usually look kind of in that top down approach. Okay, where is the money flowing from an equity standpoint, asset class standpoint, then getting into the sectors within the US and Canada, we are seeing financials. We talked about Bank of America. There is a group of banks, both in Canada and the US, that are, as we've seen historically, almost too large to fail because of the bailout situation, because of the support they would get of how they can affect the economy. But we are seeing still those money flows go towards financials. It's not our favorite pick, but it still is an outperformer kind of year to date versus the rest of the market. And, you know, especially over the last 3 months has still kind of stayed the course. IT, we are seeing that pull back and weakening. No surprise there with the strong start to the season. But really the sector that, you know, we continue to see one of the biggest losers is real estate. I think both in Canada and the U.S. Has been an underperformer because of the interest rate has stayed higher and affected the marketing buying power of most of the market opportunities. And of course, the bigger winners have been energy and materials. The materials has been stronger on the Canadian side because of the exposure to gold prices, how that affects the gold stocks. And there's just a lot larger percentage of the market there that we would see. But energy has been obviously the strongest sector that we've seen move up, but it still hasn't cracked kind of the top four in the U.S., in terms of relative strength, but doesn't mean that there's not opportunities, again, to diversify. And I think when I showed you that report, we did see an energy name right up the top, right? So there is still those opportunities once you get into the individual holdings or through an ETF or a mutual fund to get that exposure that you need. And again, that might not be changing based on the geopolitical risks out there. If anything, that should put more pressure when the U.S. has less strategic reserves than it has in a long time, when there's, again, the Strait of, what's the one, not the Red Sea one, but the other one between Iran and and Saudi Arabia, yeah, straight up Hamas, or don't quote me on that, but Raz, you know, those kind of things are 20% of the world's oil goes through that strait, right? So if that gets closed off, you're going to see those short-term impacts on energy. But really, that hasn't made its way into the market as much as I personally thought it would. But it's still, again, an opportunity. You just have to look at that opportunity cost. Would I rather be in those kind of names or more defensive names? Again, we're starting to see some more defensive sectors, even like utilities, move up. And so those are the kind of trends that we're going to start seeing if the market correction or, you know, reversal starts happening. And we are in that seasonality time of the year. I don't think we should expect every month to be a winning month here. I mean, the second quarter usually of every year is, especially May, April, historically seasonality is pretty weak. And maybe I'll just pull up a quick seasonality chart to kind of show what I'm talking about. You know, the yellow, the green line is, you know, year to date so far this year. And then the blue one is the average of the Dow Industrial over that time period. So usually we see kind of the sell in May go away. We saw that last year quite a bit. We saw that last year in February as well. But to start the year, we had three positive months and then a pullback in April. We're still in April, so this will change as we go. And then we saw a rally kind of in June, July last year with a week kind of August to October. So we're kind of in a seasonality kind of slower time period starting in May and June. And then usually in the kind of late, early fall, late summer months, we're also going to see that seasonality come back with usually an end strong year. But I think, Mike, you had also mentioned the presidential cycle. And that was another kind of takeaway of, you know, there's a lot of numbers up here, but I'll just try to quickly summarize this. Now, this is to April 10th. It's a little bit older, but still, we had a strong start to the year, up 5.5% again, the first quarter. And historically, usually, you know, a Q4 going into a presidential kind of cycle where there's election going on, there's a lot of uncertainty, right? You see that in 2007. You see that in other years where, again, there's a lot of risk out there in the markets. And usually what we see is a stronger third year compared to the fourth year historically. Obviously, 2008 is affecting those averages, but it's still, when you look at the breakdown, there's a lot of that in kind of the averages too. So third year of a presidential cycle, doesn't matter who the term is, who, whether Republican or Democrat, we see like a 13.8% average. The fourth year is usually a 2%. So whether that's going to, you know, if we're around that number right now, which I think it's a little bit higher, but, you know, that's something to keep in mind that I think this year is going to have more volatility, especially than we experienced last year. It might look a little bit more like 2022, where you're having some more seasonality effects. So is this all roses going forward? Not necessarily. But at the same point, we want to simplify that as much as possible to say, okay, well, if I do need to invest, where do I want to be? Here's, you know, kind of what are our rankings that change all the time, every day, based on the money flows. And then if we look at Canada here real quick, well, again, we see energy right at the top, obviously the largest performer with materials moving up. And we still see that strength from the industrials, still see the materials, financials isn't as high as it is in the US. We still see the weakness in more so in the communications and real estate area and utilities kind of in the Canadian side. So there's not as much diversity here in Canada. Again, like, for example, the healthcare is maybe 2 to 3 stocks that actually move that market, maybe down to 2 now. It's more volatile for sure. But obviously the commodities are driving this. It's no secret. We'll see if that continues. Again, historically, those runs are shorter. But again, there's a lot of reasons why energy could stay up higher. Same thing with materials as we go forward, especially if some of the emerging markets like China start actually bouncing back, that it is going to keep commodity prices higher a little bit faster. But those things can change faster than anything. So definitely that's why having a system just to help you understand whatever system that is, those money flows, where things are moving, can help you kind of position yourself going forward. It doesn't need to be a day trading kind of scenario, but just want to make sure that your risks are appropriate going forward, especially if the market starts pulling back. These will start changing pretty quickly of where those opportunities might be going forward. So, Mike or Pierre, do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, and if we Yeah. If you flip back to your U.S. sectors, I mean, you know, the nice thing is in Canada, we do get exposure. Well, the nice thing can be in certain regimes that you get exposure to energy. Certainly over the last several years, it's been a rougher place to be with all the exposure to energy and materials because they haven't really performed. When you look at the S&P sector analysis, the things that catch my eye are utilities starting to have performance. That is a sign that institutional dollars are moving away from those areas that have provided them growth and moving towards things that provide certainty. So return of capital, not return on capital to some degree. So again, you know, I wouldn't sign or put a red alarm up yet, but that's like a yellow light. And then the other thing is the energy sector. And this is, you know, pervasive with oil and then across all of the energy subsectors in the US, where it's not just the commodity, the stocks and the various areas within the energy complex are all pointing to this and have breakouts that have been very, very long patterns where they haven't achieved these prices before. XLE in the US that represents the energy index is breaking out and showing a pattern that's like 15 years of not ever being at these prices. And that's not getting a lot of coverage. Yeah. And here's the problem. Is energy a big part of the economy? You're goddamn right it is. And what does it represent of the S&P from the standpoint of market cap? It represents 4% of the market cap. If your exposure is largely to American stocks, you are woefully underexposed any kind of energy shock. So just to put this in context, Microsoft is worth, you know, $3 trillion and has $67 billion in free cash flow. The energy sector in the S&P is worth about $1.6 trillion, half, a little more than half. And its free cash flow is $135 billion, double. Now, that's not a slight against Microsoft. They've got a lot of AI. They got a lot of stuff that's very positive for Microsoft. But in a portfolio where you have a scenario right now geopolitically where oil prices could spike, you have no hedge in your S&P 500. You have a 4% hedge. You're going to get murdered. And just, you know, energy prices, while they are inflationary via the CPI, they're actually a tax. If you have to put more money in your gas tank, you have less money to spend. Yes, it's higher inflation, but it also stagnates growth. It's inflationary stagnation. So Wiley at BlackRock mentioned that a $10 increase in oil shaves 20 to 30 basis points off of global GDP. We go back to that yield curve inversion that we talked about. We go back to 1928. We go back to 2008. We go back to the 70s. In most cases, all cases except for two, with the tech bubble being one of the cases, an oil shock is what caused the, it was the straw that finally broke the camel's back. Yes, you had an inverted yield curve across the board. Check. How long has it been inverted? Really long. What does that mean? Well, it usually means when you have a recession, it's a really deep, hard, and long one. Okay, great. What's the energy sector doing? It's picking up steam. Why is it picking up steam? Well, there's a lot of uncertainty around that, and we have $90 oil. You get $100 oil, and you get a shock that resonates through all of what's going on in the Middle East. Doesn't take long to get to a scenario where you're going to have other sectors doing well, and you're going to need to rotate your portfolio, and in particular in the U.S., because the market capitalization weightings are so skewed to areas that will not benefit from that. So, you know, these are just, you know, these are my musings, just things that I see, and I'm like, I don't know if that's going to happen, but boy, oh boy, that plate is set.
That's a great soundbite. I love that. I love the, you know, the relative size distinction that you made, Mike, about Microsoft versus the entire energy sector. But I think, you know, it's reflected. It's, you know, if you look at this table, I mean, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, the last quarter, the last year performance for the energy sector, but also that it's moved up three spots in the quarter. Gives you an indication that there's some momentum there, even though it's ranked number seven versus, you know, largely IT and financials, industrials. You know, the obvious, those seem to be the obvious, you know, fallback choices for investors because of the bias against energy stocks, you know, because of, you know, 10 years of underinvestment in energy. But, you know, if that doesn't, like for Canadians, maybe it's a little bit more, you know, energy seems to be a more obvious choice since it's a larger part of the Canadians.
Well, yeah. it's 20% of the index and it's, and
but is that what investors have? I mean, so if you're buying an index fund,
right,
that's fine. But if you're, you know, you probably have the market weight in there, at least the market weight. And if you're buying an S&P 500 index, you've got the market weight of 4%. But that's, as you said, it's woefully underinvested, but it's also becoming one of those opportunities that not only provides potentially great returns, but also risk management as well versus all the other sectors that are above it in this ranking.
Yeah. And it's a point of crisis, right? So if you want to hedge in your portfolio to the things that have been working, then you're going to look for those, you know, highly relative strength oriented positions, maybe within those sectors, or you're going to add those sectors. Or if you're in Canada and you do have, you know, sort of the Canadian weight, I mean, you are more protected than an American investor. But, you know, Canadians are going to be subject to the same, you know, vagaries of behavior, performance chasing. And they probably have portfolios that are a little bit more oriented towards tech and more oriented towards that sector. And, you know, I don't know, Paul, if you have a chart of XLE, like something longer term that you can show on point and figure that kind of can show people what we're talking about, like on a very long-term basis, you know, this is happening, right? It's not happening. It's happening. and it's one of those things where nobody's talking about it, right? The market index weight in the U.S. is 4%. This is a clear and present danger to U.S. portfolios. It's less of a clear and present danger to Canadian portfolios, but, you know, where do Canadians lie on that? I'm not sure. Each individual investor is going to have to take a look at where their portfolio lies, but that's going back a long way, and you can take it back all the way to the 2008 highs. And we're just breaking those. So again, when you have a sector that's this big, and then you've had two massive energy deals in the US over the last few months, and it's at new highs, this is new thinking, right? And so this is where investors should be very careful that the feeling is that you wanna take those little gains that you get. No. You want to hold on to those gains. And if something shows you a loss, murder that. But as these gains are happening, when you have no resistance, nobody's owned it at these prices before, there's no unhappy investors. And the fact that only 4% of the S&P is in it, again, that's an interesting setup to me. Now, could it all, you know, go by the wayside and correct down? Yeah, and you'd have your stop loss. You have a very manageable stop loss, very, very tight place to say, no, I'm wrong, and you know, things are going to be okay. But, you know, this is one of those early trends.
It's also, I mean, if you look, like, you know, sentiment for energy stocks has been, you know, warped as well. I mean, it's been overshadowed, first of all, by technology and the bias towards, you know, investors chasing technology. But, you know, underneath it all, it's also been warped by, you know, this anti-fossil fuel school of thought, which is, you know, which is also curving sort of the emotionality of wanting to get into the sector and maybe feeling conflicted that you are, you know, at the same time. I, you know, because...
Reference Doomberg here. I'll reference our call with Doomberg on that.
And so I mean, to me, that's like a coiled spring, right? I mean, you've potentially got a really, you know, big asymmetric upside for energy here, that investors will look back on, perhaps years from now, saying, "Wow, I can't believe I ignored that, or I didn't see that coming," or for whatever the reason. But I think the big one, the big overhang is technology, and maybe that'll end up being a hangover. We go from overhang to hangover, and then you miss, you miss energy because you were looking at the more obvious names, rather than than. Yeah.
Well, you were still trying to bottom fish.
Yeah.
On Tesla. you could probably show Constellation Energy as well, Paul. You've got something set up, so I don't know if you have something you want to add. So.
Let's continue. I think we've made the point. But guys like Eric Nuttall, portfolio managers like Eric Nuttall, have been screaming about the underinvestment in energy for a decade. We had on our other podcast, we had Cole Smead from Smead Capital Management, having more or less the same conversation with us about energy and how it's completely being under-recognized, underrepresented, under-recognized. This is one of those things where, investors will most likely, investors will probably miss the boat late.
Well, they'll get in eventually, but the need for electrons is going to continue to grow, and those electrons are going to come from hydrocarbons, and we have the confirmation of strangers here, but it's not popular in the media, which is a great setup trait. That is a good situation, and I think gold. I don't want to miss talking about gold, but I think gold is another setup that is an awful lot like that. But I don't know if we want to kind of. I know it probably is not represented here in the sector analytics, but I don't know if you're doing cross-asset stuff as well.
Yeah, I had a little bit of analysis on gold we could get into real quick, but just kind of looking, one of the kind of main takeaways, if you look back the last 15 years, usually, and I think you talked about it, Mike, kind of earlier, like same kind of idea of an inverse interest rate curve, like we're also seeing kind of the 10-year rate, usually it goes up, while gold goes down. We saw that again in 2019, into 2020. And the difference recently has been gold is moving up at the same time interest rates are moving up. And that's been a real divergence from historical, kind of especially the major trends. And so I wanted to point that out and also kind of highlight the strength of gold versus things that you usually actually see in the media quite a bit. Everybody's talking about Bitcoin. Guess what has outperformed Bitcoin on a three-year basis? Guess what has outperformed the NASDAQ comps at over a three-year basis? It's gold, right? It's unsurprisingly, it's, the unsexy trade, talking about energy in the U.S. and absolutely another opportunity, like you mentioned, Mike. This is, maybe not as of current. I don't know if they've all caught up yet, but because of the huge drawdowns that we saw in both these areas in 2022, obviously I'm cherry picking the 3-year period, but it kind of highlights that, even though Bitcoin's up historically this year, it still hasn't even caught up to a very basic safe gold trade over the last couple of years. And there's many reasons for, kind of gold, going up that much. We don't need to get into all those here today, but I did want to factor a couple of them. Obviously the inflation hedge is commodities rally. There's been more interest in gold because of the financial risks out there. So we're seeing that. And historically, we've seen that as well. Found this quick tidbit as well, that Costco is one of the reasons they're driving up so much, selling 200 million in gold bars and silver coins each month. And to put that in perspective, I think China as a whole buys about 400 million a month. So Costco is basically doing half of what major economies are buying. Out there from a standpoint of, so I don't think this trend will continue as people realize that, hey, you can't return those gold bars and you're not going to get the resale value you think about those. But it just kind of puts in that fear of the market that people are looking elsewhere to do that, rather than maybe making some of the other trades out there they just didn't even know that they should be making. But there's a lot of reasons that gold's moving up. I don't think that that trend is going to stop, but also I wouldn't expect another 30% run, even if all these things come true and there's a higher financial risk. There is some things that will level out there as well, but it is interesting to see kind of that movement towards materials. And like we said, I think that's affecting the Canadian economy a lot more because there's a lot more exposure to that that area, much more than the U.S. and the materials sector. So again, definitely don't recommend going to buy gold bars right now, but it just kind of highlights the risk that people are seeing kind of personally, maybe. Yeah. Where they're the average person out there, like you said, okay, oil prices are going up. They have less money to spend. They still need to put oil in their car. They still need to feed their family. They still need to pay their bills. So they're using, you know, that extra income for maybe safety nets if that's what they kind of personally feel going forward. So a lot of factors at play.
Well, it's confidence. It's confidence in the currency and the amount of money that's been printed and the potential for yield curve control. Which happened in the post-war era of the 1930s and 1940s. The long-term yields were pinned at 2%, and they printed as much debt as they needed to print, printed as much money as they needed to print to pay off the debt. And there was a debasement of the currency and a monetization of the debt. And in a scenario like that, that's when interest rates go up, and at the same time, gold goes up. This is, again, you start to think about the some of the signs. I see the signs. You know, you get a scenario where you get an oil shock, you get some sort of recession, so tax receipts aren't as high, government needs to spend more money. There's this geopolitical issue too, which is you've confiscated money from Russia because they invaded Ukraine, and then you've turned around and given that money to the Ukraine. That is a watershed moment that happened only a day or two ago. That is mind blowing, and it creates a realization of countries around the world that the US Treasury is not a place that they can keep their money, because if they do something that the US doesn't like, it will selectively default on that. Confiscate the wealth and give it to the enemy.
It's feeding also Russia, you know, the domestic conspiracy, you know, tin hat story that the Treasury can confiscate your wealth, you know.
So now you have China. So the price of gold in China is more expensive than the price of gold in London. So what's happening is gold is moving from the west to the east. It's going to Shanghai, and metal is being moved there. And that's because countries don't have faith if they do something that the U.S. doesn't like, and they're going to have confiscation of their assets. Not only that, but then assets given to, you know, the person, the entity that they may be fighting, and Russia is a United Nations member. This is not these are pretty dramatic steps. So. You know, the other thing is gold. These are all-time highs for gold, right? And again, I come back to when you get into all-time highs, nobody's unhappy. At the same time, here's the thing that really kind of gets me marginally excited, I guess excited, is that while we have a rally to new highs in gold, and while gold has outperformed these other asset classes, Paul points out, over the last 3 years, do you know what the AUM in the various gold exchange traded products is doing? It's going down. GLD has 30% less AUM than it did 2 years ago.
So what does that mean?
So retail clients and institutional clients are not responsible for this growth in the price.
Retail.
It's not retail.
Oh,
it's
central banks.
Governments of the world. It's central banks are buying the physical gold. They're buying it in London and they're shipping it to Shanghai. They're buying it in India. They're buying it in places because they can't trust the current hegemony to honor the holding of their assets if they do something that they don't like. So there's this move away from the US dollar as the prime currency in the world. And that movement has gold as part of it. So there's not much gold around. If this has all been done via physical buying, when the retail, and it's not just retail, right? ETFs are not only a retail game for buying gold. Institutions also hold gold via exchange traded products. They don't generally hold gold physically.
Well, it makes it a hell of a lot easier to unload it if you want to.
Correct. Yeah. And rebalance it within the portfolio, all those things, right? So, you know, there's a setup here that's interesting. When gold finally catches, you know, when gold investors at large finally catch wind, there will be a supply squeeze. And so, you know, in that scenario, you could see gold go up a lot in a very short period of time, because there just won't be any around. And so those, you know, structures that hold it, like, you know, the ETFs that are exchange traded products that actually hold the underlying assets, maybe slight preference there versus those that are created out of futures products. But the futures products should also reflect the pricing and is obviously cheaper, you know, from the standpoint of if you're going to buy an exchange traded product. So lots to think about there. But, you know, having a zero allocation to gold or having a low allocation to gold is probably not a good idea at the moment. And the trend in AUM of the exchange traded products is down.
That's bizarre, actually.
And that is crazy when something's hitting all-time highs.
Like, I think you're seeing that affect the currency as well, right? Like, you're seeing the strength of that US dollar across the board. Like, I don't remember seeing, this is kind of a year-to-date chart, but across the board, especially point out the yen earlier up about 10% versus that. If we look at kind of other major currencies, it's a little bit more mixed, but the strength of the US dollar is really being highlighted here versus other opportunities here, especially recently. And this kind of is a more mixed bag, but you see again, the versus the yen is really affecting those global markets and the price of gold as it's getting traded internationally. This is an important part that a lot of people miss. They don't really look at the currencies. They don't look at the impact of that changing. I mean, that's a 10% move. That could be the whole economy or more than GDP expected for a lot of these countries. And that's just 4 months of a currency trade going against you or for you. So that's something to keep in mind of how that's going to affect it going forward. Usually the safety nets of US dollar, the yen, we're seeing a divergence there more than historically between those two. The US dollar is gaining strength across the board and the yen is losing that strength across the board. So that's something to keep in mind too, as international traders and people that are trading commodities. That's not normally on people's top of mind, but it's an important factor. And that's hopefully what this podcast can help people understand, is there is opportunities out there in energy, in gold, in currencies, in futures, in different areas of the market. It's not just those key Magnificent Seven stocks. There's still opportunities there too. Yeah. That's what you're going to hear about in the news. But the power of having a system or being able to analyze this kind of depth of information is always the opportunity cost. If you, Pierre, had $10,000 to invest today, where's the best place to put your money? We want to help answer that question and point people in the right direction, because it doesn't really matter where you put that as long as you're getting hopefully the best bang for your buck, right, and the best opportunity going forward, but hopefully the lower risk.
Amazing. So is there anything that you're seeing, Paul, on, you know, underneath the surface? In the current scenario, so you know, we've kind of talked about ways in which one could look to bring other asset classes and other exposures in the portfolio that would round out the diversification potentially. But let's step into the can we go into the bullish percents a little bit on some of the indices and some of those underlying the breadth indicators, and sort of walk us through what you're seeing here as well, maybe across the main in indices like the US and
It's actually pretty balanced across the board. Usually you want to see kind of a standard deviation chart where it's higher peaked in the middle,
right?
There's a little bit more movement towards the left hand side. The one kind of outlier is what we've already talked about, energy, metals and mining kind of over here on the right hand side that are maybe overbought a little bit, but we already talked about the reasons for that. There is more momentum, more trend following kind of into those areas and still opportunity. basis on the actual underlying fundamentals, like you talked about earlier with XLE and then kind of the lower percentage. Now, I don't think we're seeing that as much in Canada. I think we are seeing more money flows towards that, but there still is major opportunities there, especially when you look at Canada as a whole. There's more money domestically flowing out of the country, less global money coming in than ever before. And the recent budget, politics aside, is not setting that up for the future investment back into the country if there's higher capital gains and other things on that kind of international investment. So that could, again, this is looking at kind of a combination of the U.S. and Canada with a weighting bias towards more the U.S. But, you know, some of the opportunities on the other side of things, we talked about real estate being an area to avoid. Well, it's, again, there's a lot of money flowing out of that sector, drugs, electricals, automotive. Again, we're seeing Tesla pop today, but we'll see if that trend continues. Is that just a cover short selling kind of very small move, or is this going to, you know, trend into something larger, right? So not a whole lot to take away from this if we go back kind of.
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. I might point out, you know, you got electronics and semiconductors, been a very powerful trend. And a lot of those trends are just checking back to maybe their 50-day and a couple of circumstances they're on their 200-day. But, you know, after a powerful move like that, you'd expect to have a little bit of a pullback. And what's neat to see is this is your opportunity. It's never easy, though, is it? Never easy. So you got your semis, you might have missed out, or maybe you trimmed some, and you're looking back in the semi area. Because it's the green box, the trend is still positive. You're still kind of on I-90. You're just taking a bit of a detour, and your rubber band is stretched a little bit to the left of the distribution. That's a place where you would normally think about adding. Now, and if you're adding there, thinking about what you're risking versus, you know, had you added a month or two ago, trying to chase the top. You at least now have, you know, some place where you can manage some risk. You've had a little pullback. So again, you know, it's not just about, okay, here's some, you know, unknown, lessly covered, you know, areas like energy or gold. You got your tried and true areas that are still pretty much on I-90 north. I mean, the semiconductor area is still kind of trucking north. And a pullback is a place where you'd probably look at.
Like, I mean, you have all the green boxes sitting on top of the sector scope, right? And that kind of gives you an indication that while there's still upward momentum, as Mike pointed out, again, it's just another systematized view of opportunity, right? These stocks have pulled back, you know, to the left side of the distribution, and you know, you might consider, like, if you wanted to add money to electronics electronics, semiconductors, now is looking like a more favorable time than a month ago or 2 months ago.
Yeah. And what is $95 billion of government spending and spending going to do to the aerospace and defense sector, right? And Britain doubled down on spending higher percentage of their GDP towards, their defense as well, right? Like, this is a lot of the NATO kind of countries are really supporting this sector, and that is an opportunity. You might not agree with their decisions, but you do want to take advantage of that information in the market, and we can help hopefully for that, or just based on that information alone, there is going to be opportunities that there. And we even saw one of the largest companies in the world, GE, spin off part of their company just to focus on that area, right? And then the other, I guess, core segment of their historical business is kind of in the utility sector. So that could also be part of the reason we're seeing some of those flows there, is that kind of attraction of capital towards restructuring of their company. So there's definitely some opportunities, like you said. I mean, semiconductors, like, the demand for AI is not going away. It's exponentially increasing every 3 to 6 months. And the same thing, maybe not exponentially, but on the defense standpoint, there is going to still be opportunities there, either through individual companies, ETFs, mutual funds, whatever your investment vehicle is. Those are the kind of trends you want to stay on top of. And again, I don't think following just a general S&P 500 kind of going forward the rest of the year is going to be the best performing strategy. I think it is going to be really more sector specific, following those trends, and energy might not keep on the run that it's on for the next 6 months. So you might need to rotate that back into semiconductors, things like that. It might be a little higher volatility year as the uncertainty of the interest rate hikes. If those don't actually go forward, we will see some pressure on the overall CPI to start, you know, making some moves at some point from the Fed and Bank of Canada to put some pressure back on this. And that's what we want to take advantage of here is, okay, which sectors are going to benefit from those decisions that we don't know about yet. And also the geopolitical event risk out there in the market are affecting certain sectors as well. So,
and construction,
I think it is more of a sector play. Yeah.
You've got construction at the top of right there. Yeah. Is that now partly the Inflation Reduction Act? Is that infrastructure and home builders, like the, you know, the home building trend because of the shortage, housing shortage?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're seeing.
See, those are even like, you know, an obvious, you know, everybody, you know, people usually tend to couple, you know, real estate, which at least commercial real estate's at the bottom of the barrel right now. But, you know, home building is not. And infrastructure is just getting started.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, that spending bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, that may have come into power in the last, you know, the last year, but it takes years for that money to find its way into projects. Right.
Absolutely.
Not to mention, you know, the bridge in Baltimore, sort of speeding up some of the emergency spending. Right.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, you've got the illegal immigration across the border. Those folks all need homes. I mean, it's very interesting. And there's a lot of cross currents in there that can be confusing, but again, it comes back to, you know, you pick your spot, you pick your risk. If it wins for you, keep it. If it loses, abandon it and disavow it as quickly as you possibly can.
All right.
Anything else, Paul, that you've got on the docket that is particularly novel or that you want to get across the waves?
I thought I would just end with maybe, okay, we've talked about a lot of the information. How can you actually put this in action? And I thought I would just highlight quickly, you know, just a 5-stock model that, you know, we're pushing out to subscribers in the U.S. or Canada. And what does this actually look like when you actually start trading? And this is just for information purposes, but what this could do is, okay, here we have still exposure to NVIDIA and Meta and some of the names we've talked about, and here's GE Aerospace. Here's some of the kind of year-to-date performances. Up 37% in this 5-stock model, right? So this is diversified by sector. This is just taking advantage of actually what we just talked about, just following those trends. Will this continue? Probably not. And not every pick's going to be a winner, but this is what it can look like just in reality of simplifying that process into, okay, what does that actually look like when we're creating or following a strategy? It can be as simple as just trying to reduce the noise out there in the market and, hey, we're going to take advantage of this. We don't see energy in here because of the U.S., but if I click to the 5-stock Canadian model, then we would have more energy names, things like that. Actually, we don't right now because some of the names have been so strong and haven't hit their sell signals, but our next buy would be that if we could get into it and still shows the diversification opportunities in the market. So just a quick, couple takeaways.
Can you walk through a little bit of how you sure. do that? Like, can you walk through a high level of it? So what's the process to get qualified for the 5-stock portfolio and then maintain exposure?
So all we're trying to do here is just simplifying, saying, hey, if you look at the 100 biggest companies in the U.S. and you can only buy one per sector, all we're doing here is saying, hey, if we buy 5 names from this list, diversify by sector, that's what it's going to be. So we're buying in this kind of green zone, the top 25% of the report. And then I think NVIDIA was one of those names. Looks like it's having a pullback. We'll see. That could be a trade by the time this podcast is released. you know, within mm-hmm. the next couple days, weeks, depending on its future kind of trend and opportunity. But I think Meta was another name. GE, Eli Lilly were the top three in right. that list. And again, those aren't really going to go anywhere. So it's as simple as basically saying, hey, we're going to hold these names as long as they're kind of in the top 25% of opportunities. And we're going to sell it if it hits the red zone, which is the bottom 50% of the report. And we're going to reevaluate it if it hits this yellow zone. So if NVIDIA does hit that because of its secondary signal, which is kind of a short-term, you know, kind of comparison score versus other opportunities, that would potentially be a sell as well in that sample model. So it's just trying to simplify saying, hey, rather than buying the index that it's heavily weighted towards IT, maybe I do want to have a 20% energy exposure or however names that is in your strategy. It really tries to simplify that, and it gives the customization ability for advisors to create their own strategies and provide that value add for their clients going forward so that they can have that competitive advantage, that simplicity, and also overlay their own research onto it. So if they come in here and say, okay, I really like what Wells Fargo is doing and it's moving up the rankings, it kind of confirms their fundamental or their other research that they're looking at it with the timing maybe aspect of it a little bit as well. So yeah, just trying to simplify, you know, all the information we talked about today into, okay, practical matters. Here's how you can hopefully benefit from that and gain that kind of insight.
I think for advisors, that's a great sort of starting point. You know, it's a great, you know, easy way to get a glimpse of how they could start to use it without getting into, you know, a rabbit hole that could potentially have them, you know, procrastinate or not procrastinate, but be, you know, hesitant to get yep. started because it seems like such a big nut to crack to just suddenly adopt a new system. But if you can just take, you know, a light version example where you say, you know, here's a great way to start thinking about it and how you know, an easy way to start using it. That's a terrific yep. tool tip. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not an all or none, right? So you've got your portfolio. Maybe you're broadly diversified in some ETFs, yep. exchange traded funds with market cap weighting. You know, you've got some sort of stock bonds. What in you're taking 10% of the portfolio, 20% of the portfolio, and allocating to a more concentrated portfolio of names. You know, with less attention to the actual market cap weightings in order to provide some extra performance or differentiated performance, you know, something that I think portfolios are going to be challenged by as we move forward over the next 10 years is, you know, the likely fact that inflation is going to remain sticky. It's going to be higher for longer. And I'm not sure the bond market has priced mm-hmm. that in quite yet. So 2022 is indicative of how, you know, portfolios can go through a lot of pain when stocks and bonds correlate. And you know, bonds have been a non-correlated stable asset, you know, from 1982 to 2022. 2022, yep. that changed a bit. And inflationary regimes, that relationship is reversed, i.e. stocks and bonds correlate. So now you have to think through, what are the other asset classes? What are the other ways in which I can impart some diversity to the portfolio? Whether it's via individual names yourself, whether it's via adding asset classes that might be diversifiers yep. or approaches that might be diversifiers that can help fill the void that bonds will create if we're in an inflationary environment. So it's just not going to be a, you know, stocks, bonds, easy sit on your hands yep. scenario potentially over the next number of years. So, you know, this is, you know, meaningful. This yeah. can have meaningful impact.
I think for, you know, for and then on the practice side, I mean, having access to, you know, a live top picks list anytime you need it, you know, best ideas.
Yep.
I mean, people watch CNBC and BNN Bloomberg, and they're always, you know, every guest that comes on, almost every guest that comes on has a top pick or something that they're, yeah, But that
we
but
have
that,
to.
Well, I know, Mike, because you know, but that's the thing, right?
And then a guy who does
that's the hook,
that's,
right?
That's the thing that gets the financial the media, man. Yeah,
yeah. But for advisors, it's a matter of practice. I mean, you know, like, what can I talk about? Like, if someone says to me, you know, oh, what are you looking at right now? Oh, I'm looking at these five names, and they literally they just did not have to think about it too hard. Not much time. Having, you know, spent, oh, let me scour the market and see what I can come up with for this particular client who's asking me. But it's instantaneous, right? You just log in from wherever you are and boom, you know, you've got something to go on.
And again, you can set some rules around it. So you're going to have five stocks, and when they go in the portfolio, it's 10% stop loss. And one of them, you know, gets kicked out, that's out, and
they
then
can,
I'll look in the
you know,
list
change
for something
the screens,
else.
Right, anytime setup. They want.
I mean, of course. So there's a lot there that can be customized in a way that's makes it streamlined in the ability to provide the advice to the end client.
Yeah, and that's what we try to do at SI Charts is power the advisor with hopefully efficient time-saving research and sample strategies, but we also know that every advisor is different. So we try to help them customize what fits best around their practice, while also offering that research and insight that we talked about today. And Mike Muir had great points to add to that as well in terms of, yeah, here's the opportunities. Even if your strategy doesn't have that energy component, that hopefully is a major takeaway from today of, okay, here's how I can get that exposure. Here's how I can add to that strategy. Or internationally, hey, don't have the exposure I want to in these developed markets or these areas. Like, that's the kind of actionable insight that we try to help people with so that they're not spending hours on research. They can come in here and do that analysis of every country in the world against each other through ETFs and narrow their focus down. Hey, I'm going to do more research into Japan, into Poland, into whatever area of the market that they're looking at for those opportunities. So that's the goal, is there's so much depth of information and there's only more coming at the advisor on a day-to-day basis, more vehicles, more structured products, more, you know, different types of alternative strategies that really complicate, but can be great situational opportunities as well to add to their book of business. But how do you navigate through all those to see which is the best? And you need a system, whatever that system is, to help eliminate some of that noise. Just like you see on the news and the media, there's a lot of noise out there. How do you really get to the main core, the what's driving the markets or where my opportunities are? So we're not the best of that easier, but we do try to focus a lot, especially on the top-down approach and the investment sides where, you know, you can see some of those visuals we went through today, how hopefully easy it is to see, okay, yeah, I do want to look into geo airspace a little bit more, or I really always like Meta or Facebook and like where they're going. Okay, now there's more confidence behind that too, or an you know, a timely sell signal to when to cut bait and when to get out.
So Paul, SIAcharts.com, that's where people can find you, that's where advisors can find you, and you have you have an introduction or a trial that they can take advantage of if they've never tried it, have never used it.
Yeah, our service comes with a 3-week free trial, and anybody listening to this podcast and made it to the end, we appreciate you. And we're going to extend that trial. We're going to give you basically an extra free month. So just mention advisor analyst when you sign up for a trial, and that will give you an extra free month, $400 value for listening to us today. And also follow us on social media, follow Raise Your Average on social media, listen, subscribe. We appreciate everybody
and,
listening
you know
to
what?
Us today.
Yeah. Well, we can always put it to the beginning if we want to. But you know what? In case you're wondering, you know, this is not a situation where, you know, you'll log in for the first time and start looking around. I think if anything, you're more likely to be blown away by it rather than you know what happens all too often with software is disappointment. This is not the case with SIA Charts. I mean, this is a robust, full, you know, very granular system that you can dive into as much or as little as you want, play around with it, customize it. But, you know, not that it goes without saying that SIA Charts has an onboarding process as well to introduce you to how to use this tool, because while it's you know, while it looks easy, because Paul makes it look easy to use when we're running through slides and looking at live screens, you'll want to know how to use them, and they're valuable. It's a real time saver. You know, it's a motivation. It can, you can also look at it as a motivational tool, because, you know, when markets do become disheartening, and you're all out of energy, and you know, which can happen, you know, all you have to do is just check in and you'll see where the ideas are, where the market is, where you can pivot to if you need to, what you can pick up the phone and call your clients about anytime you want. You know, don't underestimate this tool. You know, the reason Paul is here with us is because he does have something valuable to share. And anyways, with that, Paul, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to catch up with it's always amazing. There's always an incredible wealth of readily available information at your fingertips. You always have a take on things, and it's great to have you.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate your insight as well. And I look forward to coming on again.
Yeah, next quarter.